Right.
But hang on, just like, was it hot chat action?
Yes.
Can I remind you that this is now going on a public server. So,
brilliant.
Yeah.
No, brilliant. Okay, all right.
Hi, this is Steve, aka at AllAnthar on Twitter, and here are some more of my gaming vexes. This time, I'm looking back over a series of sessions I ran for the Liminal RPG. Liminal is a game of modern urban fantasy, rooted very firmly in the myth and folklore of the British Isles, written by Paul Michener, and after a successful Kickstarter, is now being published by Modiphius. There's also a range of scenarios available on DriveThruRPG, and the first full sourcebook for the game, Pax Londinium, has just been released in print and PDF. They're fantastic books, both in terms of content and presentation, and I thoroughly recommend them if you haven't encountered them already. We had a huge amount of fun during the 8 3-hour sessions we spent exploring the world of Liminal, and it's a game I'm sure we'll come back to. Adding their reflections to mine this episode are Dave, at Dave Paters on Twitter, Doc, at Dracoe, Kay, at K_O, Neil, at Old Scouts of Roleplaying, and Ozzy, at Karahemd. They each give a brief introduction to their characters in the main segment, but I thought it might be useful to give everyone else a brief overview of the mystery the crew encountered. Liminal Casebook, The Case of the Frozen Man. Ever since they came into being on the islands of Britain, two powerful entities have been locked in a struggle for dominance. The Winter King held sway in the far north, but was determined to drive humanity out of the wild places. Another entity claims sovereignty over the middle lands of England, from the ancient kingdom of Reged southwards. After many clashes, the Winter King drove his opponent southwards into the lands of Mercia. Here, the Fey Lord of Reged became known in folklore as the Ragged King, and there he remained, nursing his enmity against the Winter King. As is well known, the Winter King claims a mortal bride each year, sending out his servants to bring her back to his court. Although given freedom in the court, eventually his mortal queen breaks one of the king's arcane rules, and her punishment is to be frozen and placed in a hall of statues in the Winter King's palace, there to stay for eternity, unless she can be freed. Our story begins in 2005, when the Winter King's servants raided into the Ragged King's domain to find a new queen. In the human city that had become known as Birmingham, a sudden summer tornado was all that the mundane world saw. But a young woman named Bethany Hughes had been marked as the Winter King's new bride and had been taken as such. But this time, the reluctant queen had a hope of rescue from her inevitable fate as an eternal statue. A powerful human mage known as the Black Alchemist claimed her as her wife. With a deep, cold anger burning within, Lydia Mills, the Black Alchemist, vowed to save her beloved Bethany. For over a decade, Lydia Mills searched for a way to free her wife, but to no avail. The Winter King is strong within his domain. But as she began to lose hope, Lydia found allies from an unexpected quarter. The Ernst family had a lineage stretching back to the Viking raiders who had pillaged Britain in the Dark Ages. As shape-changers, able to take the form of a bear, those of the Ernst bloodline were true bear-sarkars, berserkers who slew all before them. Over the ages, the family maintained positions of power throughout what became the land of Germany, and when the National Socialists rose to power, they rose even further, only to fall as Hitler's Germany fell. But the Ernst family were not prepared to accept their fate, and swore to destroy the islands of Britain, no matter how long it took. Somehow, the Ernst family became aware of the Black Alchemist's desire to free her loved one. More, the mage was a powerful geomancer with power over ice and snow, and thus a deal was struck, brokered by the Ernst family. If the Black Alchemist used her magic to bring permanent winter to Britain, the Winter King would release his frozen queen, and the Ernst family would have their revenge. But to do this, the Alchemist would need access to powerful relics containing the very essence of the power of the British Isles. She would need access to the fabled 13 treasures of Britain. Moreover, these were not simply objects. Each was or had been a person, the power of the islands made flesh. A county archaeologist had stumbled across the grave of Penda of Mercia, the last pagan Saxon king, and also the embodiment of one of the 13 treasures. The unusual death of the archaeologist, frozen solid whilst inside a war museum building, had attracted the attention of a P division, and so our crew became entangled in this ancient struggle. Could they uncover the truth of the plot and prevent the Cabal from bringing the Fimbul Winter, the Eternal Winter, to their islands? So, should we just go around to introduce yourselves?
So, yes, my name is Kay. I play Jess, who is a somewhat crusty young sculptor and the pending embodiment of the River Trent. She's skilled in blessings and curses and can scavenge up pretty much anything in a pinch.
Hi, I'm Ozzy. I'm playing Brother Scrooter, who is a man in black, so a man of the cloth. He's also skilled in blessings and curses, but of the almost opposite variety. Seeing that in play was really good fun.
I'm Dave. I played Magpie Skull, who is a fey investigator, and with very few sort of combat skills, but lots of investigatory stuff.
I'm Doc. I played Sir Montague Proctor Beauchamp, who is a charming and bumbling middle-aged chap who lives in a stately home with his retainers, Mr. and Mrs. Hinsley.
No secrets at all.
I mean, things developed during the campaign, as they should in all interesting campaigns.
That's me in my place. All right. Okay.
I'm Neil, and I'm Old Scouser role playing on Twitter. I played Ortis Citro, who's a rogue, a bit of a, I don't know how to say this without insulting the youth out there, but he was like a bit of a...
There's no youth listening to this, so I won't worry.
And, you know, he said things like, in it, and everybody over the age of 30 was a boomer. And that was the extent of my role-playing ability. He was very good at breaking into things and stealing things.
Excellent. This isn't intended to be a review of the game at all. Obviously, we can talk about anything that comes to mind, really. But I suppose what was it about Liminal that attracted you? What made you interested in playing it?
I think it was having played it at Grogton when Dave ran it for us, his fantastic game set in Tenby. Yeah, it was fantastic. It was, I think the fact that it was local, but it had all this underlying sense of mystery and this alternate world. It came across really well. And I really like the system. I love light systems. I think it was just a great combo, the setting and the system.
Yeah, just to say the system essentially is 2d6 plus a skill, and usually get 8 or more. So there's a lot of flexibility. We can talk a bit more about the system later on, if you like. But yeah, so you played it previously, and you got that idea of background. So what were our thoughts about the background?
I think I would have said that one of the things that really attracted me to Liminal, for me being a bit of a Call of Cthulhu nerd, was that it's one of those games you didn't have to explain anything. So you're in a sort of a modern setting, you're in a realistic setting, but with surreal overlays. And the other thing is, what you could also do is you could build a sort of a scenario or links or clues around just being able to go on the internet or click a link and follow it to a Google map, or you would...
Yeah.
You do a search on, oh, hang on a second, what are the things that might be associated with the 13 treasures of England or Britain?
Yeah, yeah.
And then
whatever it was, yeah.
The danger.
Yeah. Or you could find pubs to go to.
You could find the name of a lonely landlady. But I thought that was fantastic. And, you know, as soon as we started, you're sort of straight into it. And then you're thinking, hang on a second, so somebody's died. Is there any CCTV? Let's go and have a look. And that was, I just thought it was fantastic, where you could use the things that you know instead of having to suppress the things that you might know. So almost like metagaming is actually you're just gaming, you know.
So, I mean, what about its build as being British urban fantasies? Does that come through?
Well, I really like that part of the game, and I think that's what drew me to Liminal more than anything else did, is that it is so British, and it's very British, and it's very grounded, and it feels kind of quite classic in that there was all of those British old stories there. They've just added some new stuff. It doesn't have a strong ideological stance. It's quite open. You can play things quite dark if you want to, or you can go down a historical route like we did. And I think it's got that real open potential that some of the games that you see of this kind of variety don't really have.
Yeah, I think it's got almost like a whimsical feel to it in some ways, with a bit of an edge, but it seems a bit more approachable than perhaps some other similar sorts of games.
Yeah, just on something you said earlier on about the system being a little bit redolent of Traveller. I think one of the things I always struggled with Traveller was it was just vast. But as Kay was saying, because you are in Britain, it just almost made it a bit more easy to game, I think. It had that almost inbuilt sensibility, I guess.
So, Ozzy, from your perspective, I mean, does it bring out that Britishness?
I would say so. I think there's a lot more folklore, spooky things in British folklore than there is in German folklore.
All right, it's interesting.
So now it's quite, you know, like a stereotypical thing is there will be ghosts, there will be fairies, fairies. Fairies isn't really a thing on the continent.
Okay.
Definitely not in that much detail. There are obviously the little helpers and the opposite of ones, the little beasties that do mischief. Uh-huh. You don't have that in Germany. I think there's a lot more cohesive mythological structure in Britain than there is where I come from.
No, I think what Britain's done is just nick everything from literally everybody. I think that's what we do. And we do, you know, English the language does, but culturally as well. I mean, we've nicked all the Irish stuff, the Celtic stuff. I mean, the French stuff from the continent, I mean, with, you know, all the Knights Parfait, etc. And what's amazing is it combines this incredibly rich mystical heritage with the rather sort of pernickety and mundane British sense of humour, sort of sense, you know, that you get in the Laundry Files and the Rivers of London. You know, it's got it's the mundane and the mystic, which I think works really well.
I mean, do you think it does a good job of taking those disparate elements? So we talked about the Fae, you know, we talked about ghosts, werewolves. Do you think it does a good job in a relatively short space of making that coherent?
The thing is, so we're talking about this alternate mysterious world. I think in terms of how it knits together, that's the nature of a mysterious alternate world, isn't it? Like, it can be anything. So I think that it's like Dave says, and Kay as well, that you've got this grounding in reality that we're all very familiar with. So anything that you kind of layer on top of that, it could be aliens, it could be just ghosts, it could be, you know, the Fae, all of these things, you know, and they're all fantastical. I think we're kind of conditioned these days anyway to be much more open to fantastical stuff like that anyway, from a fictional point of view.
Yeah, so there's lots of that stuff out there, isn't there, in the general zeitgeist, I suppose. But I think the game does quite a good job.
I think the other thing which is really good, and again, just to add on to what Neil was saying, you know, because you've got all the different various bits in there, I've been interested to sort of see what happened in Pax Londinium, and then sort of going back and then reading the book as well. You can do exactly what you said. So if you wanted to have a purely vampire-led story, you've got it. And because it's not only easily sort of slotted into various other things, I think it's an incredibly campaignable type game. I think you could switch, and then you could have one encounter then goes into a completely different link. And I think, you know, one of the things that was a particular strength of our sessions, of our sort of campaign and so on, was that you could suddenly find the rabbit hole you were going down, and you're thinking, oh, this can't be right, all of a sudden turns into something else, and you know, and it leads onto another bit. And I thought that was absolutely fantastic, the way you could. You started off with getting one little link, and then it was, hang on a second, what about this? This could be it. And away you go again. So I think infinitely campaignable, and that sort of British urban fantasy bit. Again, you can plot anything, as Neil was saying, you can put anything on top of that. Yeah. And it sort of, it almost makes sense and intrigues you and gets you going. So,
And on any local legends you might have, any local stories, you can turn into, now that are completely false, and you can make turn them into a palpable scenario.
I was accused at one point of actually creating a website for one of the factions. I think it was UTUC, wasn't it? That I said, actually, no, this is a real...
The Order of Fenris. Or,
what was real and what was in-game was actually quite permeable, really.
For example, for me, who hasn't read a lot of the book, a lot of the setting book, to me it wasn't clear, is this something that is written as part of the book setting, or is this something that you, Steve, as the GM, inserted?
It's just made up.
Yeah, not made up, but because if it had been made up, it would have stood out.
So one of the questions is, when you look at British Urban Fantasy, and I mean, Cale have a view on this, I'm sure, sort of having played a lot, and actually GMing a World of Darkness game yourself, what do you think differences are between this approach and the World of Darkness approach?
Well, I thought this was really interesting because the World of Darkness, the more you look at it, and if you want to compare it with Liminal, is the World of Darkness is so American, and it does have this very strong ideological stance that the World of Darkness, you know, it is, quote, the worst timeline. It is a dystopia. It's a dystopia by design. And I think, you know, it revels in this whole counterculture message to maybe the sort of Christian right in US sensibilities. And it's, you know, punk as fuck. And it loves all of that kind of stuff. But you know, Liminal, being very British, I think almost takes that very British approach in that, you know, well, some people have an ideology and some people don't. And it's kind of an omnitopia, if you like, in that we can, you know, it's all these old stories that we have, all these old British stories and the ones that we've stolen, obviously. And there's any new ones that we want to make. And, you know, ethereal beauty plus hoodies. You know, you can do whatever you want with it. And I think, you know, World of Darkness is very strict. And, it, you know, the lore on it is so vast and so detailed. Yeah. And Liminal is just like, there's lore, but you make up your own.
I mean, the word, if I was going to describe the way I've seen Liminal based on what you were talking about, it's affectionate. So it's talking about British folklore and British context. It's got a sense of humour that's built in, obviously. And it is very affectionate. And it seems to be saying, actually, World of Darkness seems it's grim. Whereas this is Britain. And actually having this overlay makes it better in some way. I don't know. What do you reckon?
I feel it's much more gentle, just generally. It might not necessarily be about kindness, but it is very gentle and it's very open to interpretation. So if you wanted to take it down a real kind of you know, Scarfolk 70s you know, folk horror way, you could easily do that and take it to somewhere super grimdark. I wanted to take it towards that, you know, Peter Grant Ben Aronovich kind of way, and definitely wanted, you know, because I wanted to be a river and all of that, and you very graciously let me do that, but the system let me do that as well. So I think, you know, the versatility here, and it is very British in its way, that says, well, you know, different strokes for different folks, and we're not going to have this crazy ideology other than do what thou wilt, and that's really interesting because that takes it right back to that old sort of, that proper sort of pagan underpinning. So World of Darkness feels like an anti-Christian message in some ways, if we're talking sort of religious ideology, and Liminal feels like it's a bit pagan. But the pagans that I know are really open-minded, and the game is also open-minded.
But I think it also brings in that Christian side of it as well, but it's all just part of the same thing. It's, you know, it's very
all-encompassing sort of thing. I actually think Kay has hit upon the marketing slogan of all marketing slogans, like ethereal beauty plus hoodies. And actually, if that's all you did to explain that to people, I think it'd be brilliant. You know, that's what are we going to do tonight? Well, we're going to play this sort of campaign. It's British urban fantasy, but essentially ethereal beauty plus hoodies.
If we just pick one image from the book itself or one thought, what would be the thing that really attracted us?
I loved the way the magic system works, because I don't normally play a magic user at all. I find it quite deep and tricky and very crunchy. But just the way that it talked about the blessings and curses, which my character had. And it was sort of really lighthearted in the, oh, something bad is going to happen to that person. It wasn't like, and you boiled their blood in their, you know, in their livers or whatever. It was a, oh, something bad's going to happen. And I'm like, well, I'm going to curse you to get a really bad cold in 2 weeks. You know, or I'm going to curse you to trip up now and fall on your face. And that, I think, is very British, and you only get that in Liminal. You don't get that in other games.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, actually. Yeah.
Really, I don't think we had the aftermath of our curses. What happened to them, you know, afterwards? Now, they could have had a bad accident. They could have, you know...
Oh, dear. That could be quite a good GM ploy, actually. So, actually, okay, now I want you to describe at the end of the session what happened to the people you cursed down the line. But, So, Ozzy, from your perspective, what's the one thing that stuck out from the game, from you, not the game we played, but the Liminal background? What's the one thing that really engages you?
Actually, the Diolus and Beans, so the character background I picked, because they are described as, you know, wanting to, you know, fight the supernatural, but at the same time also suppress it.
Uh-huh.
And that the fact that, like my character, there are magic users in the Order, while the Order despises magic.
Mm.
So I thought that...
That whole mismatch was quite...
Mismatch.
What about you, Dave? So you actually run... Obviously, you've run your own games this anyway. So what jumps out for you?
I think when I sort of first picked up the game, for me, and almost the first thing I ever do is I end up sort of photocopying a character sheet.
Yeah.
And sort of, you know, trying to sort of develop a character. And the thing I really liked about Liminal was that actually it's not... And I've got the rule book, funnily enough, in front of me now. I was just flicking through it. And the bit that really got me in the first instant was its character concepts. Mm. It's not very, very hard, rigidly defined, you know. Okay, as I think, again, as Kay was sort of saying earlier on, you know, with regard to magic, it's not you are a magic user, therefore you have this penalty and you have these boons, but you can't use this and you can do it. Yeah. Whereas with the character concepts, you know, they're as broad as an academic wizard, you know. And the other one I absolutely loved was this idea of the face. Yes. And if you remember things like Salem's Lot, where James Mason was I guess he was more of a Dampier, wasn't he? But, you know, a face, somebody representing somebody else, a gutter mage, you know, and you could just build in so much story around each of these. And for me, it was when I was sort of touching on the Fae, and again, Doc said earlier on that the Fae, obviously, I think probably leans more heavily on the Irish roots.
Yes.
How could you juxtapose Fae in a modern setting when they're sort of odd looking and how you sort of bring that into a game. And so character concepts, and then just taking it, they could be as broad as you wanted, but still within a sort of a feel.
Also the character concepts, they aren't rigid.
No.
This is sort of the thing, the kind of person you are. And these are the suggested skills.
Yeah.
They're suggested skills. You can play a completely someone that's completely opposite to that, and still fit within that concept. And you know, and the system doesn't limit you to anything.
Yeah,
and I guess there's an element of that sort of, you know, again, I think somebody touched on it earlier on. It's quite polite. Well, you know, this is the man in black who has suggested skills. You know, you don't have to take
you
it.
You may consider this.
Yeah. Or you may not. You might be educated, but then again, you know, maybe you're not. So,
well, I've not read the book, if I'm honest. So
you never read the books for any of the games. It's quite
I skimmed through them, but the thing I liked was the
pretty pictures.
The artwork is amazing.
It's really good. Jason Behnke, it's amazing. I mean, the stuff he has done. I mean, you know, Paul Michener, obviously a genius, but I mean, Jason Behnke just brings such an amazing, you know, feeling to the book. It's very light. It's beautiful. I mean, it's incredible.
So it's the thing about the organizations. I really quite like that. I thought that it had. Mm. It's almost got this like Harry Potter element to it, you know, almost serious, you know, so you've got the Council of Merlin and P Division, you know, and all these organizations that are to one degree or another part of that other world. And I thought, you know, us having different relationships with them. I don't know if we got into that so much, but I think
we didn't too much. I think because they separate character creation from crew creation, and when you sort of do the crew creation, you decide on are there any factions you're in with or out with, and that then creates a bit of a context. And actually, the whole of your crew hated the Council of Merlin, I think, but we never actually got into that. As you were saying, Dave, it's infinitely campaignable, but I left it open at the end of the series, so if anybody else wants to pick it up and to run with it, then there's plenty of grist for the mill in terms of what those stories look like. We've talked a little bit about rules, and again, I don't want to get into it's not a review as such, because we played it and we all really enjoyed it, but are there any ideas about from a mechanics perspective, like an even better if? I mean, from my perspective, we had a couple of extended combats, and then to me, I don't know, you'd be interested to get your perspective, but to me it seemed you didn't get a lot of pop because there's not a lot of crunch in the combat systems. And I got the sense after a little while I just wanted to get to the end of the combat so we can move on with the storyline. So for me, I think it's almost like it leads you down an investigative route, whereas if you wanted to go down a more let's be werewolves and go and smash stuff up, that would be a more difficult thing to do.
All I was going to say, I mean, if you think about that last encounter, the last combat where we were under siege, and I don't know, I mean, I can see maybe a couple of combats, maybe the one when we went to the werewolf guy's house and Monty was just beating up on those guys, and Monty and Jess was beating up on those guys in the streets. They weren't just like innocent guys, they were bad guys, I should say. And
they were just picking on locals.
But when we had the right at the end there, when we were in Snowdon at the cottage, I don't know, I thought that was really exciting. I thought there was a lot going on there. The combat, the whole situation felt very dynamic. And I think, you know, some powers and abilities were coming out there. There was there, because there was that whole thing about placing the items around. And there was all that stuff. I don't know, I really enjoyed that side of it, to be honest. And I think just generally as a system, I really like these games that use 2d6. Barbarians of Lemuria is another one that I really like, and I think they're probably all very similar. You know, you have a fixed target number, you add on a cup one or two or more depending on whatever abilities or stats or whatever, but I just think it's really elegant, it works well. I don't know how scalable it is, you know, whether there comes a point where your characters are so capable in everything.
I don't know, I mean, you've got the skill cap, but essentially you just as a GM you can just keep increasing the difficulty, so you can always challenge the players, and it's easy to do that on the fly as GM.
Because considering it's not crunchy at all, that jeopardy in that combat was still there. And I know that because I'd picked a character who was pretty much all about magical lore and knowing magical society, and was relatively useless in combat except for the occasional curse, that I felt that Jess was constantly in danger. And, you know, because it was like, oh, there's six guys with shotguns. And I'm like, crap, I don't know what to do about that. and it did feel, you know, again, much more real world setting. In the real world, you know, I would be going, crap, six guys with shotguns, don't think I can go up against any of that. So considering that there wasn't an awful lot of rolling involved, there was definitely a sense of being easily overwhelmed and being quite vulnerable at any point, but not necessarily in a very specific way. And for me, the theatre of the mind made that way more intense than, you know, I've got X hit points left and I know that they can do Y damage. This was much more sort of, it felt much more tangible without it being mathematical.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. So, Dave, from your perspective as somebody who's run Liminal, I mean, have you got any reflections on the system, any thoughts or any parts where you thought actually there's a little bit of a gap here, or has it all managed to work with the rules rather than against them?
I certainly understand what you mean about, you can possibly get a little bit frustrated with that lack of crunch if you're so inclined. And I know both of us are quite fans of MERP, which possibly is the other extreme. But I kind of agree again with Neil and with Kay. I think the jeopardy, I think, is also amplified by the fact that most of the creatures that you're facing are fantastical. So I think there's an element of you don't quite know how badly you could potentially be off. And when we had the fight with the was it the triad vampires at
yes, at Harvington Hall. That's right. Monty's ancestral home.
Monty's gaff. You know, I think there are a couple of points there. In fact, I was almost got involved in one little bit and virtually died. And I think we had to rescue Kay's Jess as well. So I'm with Neil with regard to the simplicity and the elegance of it. I think it's quite easy. As you said, I think what you do have to think about is balance. And I think when we were, I think Ozzy was quite a bit with sort of cursing. And when we got to get grips with the magic and stuff and got used to it a little bit more, you could then see, okay, well, we can use the system to our advantage.
Yeah.
So I think the only thing I would probably say about it is, and I think we as a group, I think we were very lucky. We're all quite experienced and can sort of be given your head. I think some people might find it a little difficult to use the system because there is a degree of interpretation that's needed by the player.
Yeah. Yes.
You almost have to say, okay, I understand what the mechanic is, but and I know you do this an awful lot when you're GMing anyway. It's okay, describe to me how that happens. Describe to me what you're doing. And I think you need a certain amount of, not imagination, because that's going to sound very rude, but you need, I guess it's a degree of being able to describe, to be descriptive, to be interpretive of the rules. And then it works to your advantage, I think. That would be my opinion. So some players coming to it have to be a bit challenged. You know, you've got to up your game here and you've got to take a bit more of a role in building the story. But it's not a story game, I don't think. It's not, because there is that element of, you know, dice rolling and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly usually that sort of middle ground, isn't it, really? So, Ozzy and Doc, any thoughts on the system in terms of an even better if?
Can't really think of
it. You can't shake your head on radio, Doc. It don't work.
Concerning magic, I would say, because it seemed to me at the beginning, I was, you know, limited to what I had on my character sheet, which was blessings and curses and the healing magic. But as it turned out later, we will also be able to do rituals. And that's not really, as far as I seen while created my character, that's not really codified in the rules.
I just made that up because I thought it sounded cool.
Right. Okay. So I was a bit lost there of what I could actually do.
Yeah.
Because am I limited to what is in my character sheet, or is it more like the World of Darkness Mage, where you can be really, really freeform with the magic,
yes,
provided you have the realms that are the spheres needed for the effect you want?
But I think Mage almost takes it to the other extreme, where you can do anything, and because you can do anything, you don't know what to do, really. It's almost like you get confused.
So that's what confused me a little bit, because that wasn't codified.
What about you, Doc?
Obviously, I'm going to jump in. As you say, I think it's a middle ground. It's a middle ground between something that's really narrative and something that's crunchy. And like you, I did sometimes feel that in things like combat, it became quite transactional. You're rolling two dice, adding a number, adding a d6, adding another number, which I think is different to Barbarians. I think Barbarians works differently. It's quicker. It's more dramatic. I found myself either wanting to go to a more crunchy system with more detail in it, or because you're a very narrative GM, we were all really into it, you know, moving to a more narrative thing like HeroQuest or something similar, where you have that fight, but it's all over in five rolls and then you narrate what happened. Because what would happen was we'd often have the dramatic stuff and then just find ourselves rolling dice. Now, I think it worked because, of course, it worked because there was good GMing, good playing. The rule system becomes much less important and we had a fantastic time with it. But I think, as you say, could it have been better in, you know, any ways? And I did find myself wanting it to go one way or the other.
I wanted to mention something I really liked in the system as well, which is the advancement system.
Yeah, I think that worked really well. Actually, I really like the
I really like that thing, because what I really dislike in other systems is leveling. But this felt more like Call of Cthulhu, which is you've done something, you were successful in doing a thing.
Yeah.
And that now gives you the ability to improve yourself. You tick a box when you learn something either about the world,
yeah,
or about one of the other characters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
because
no, it is really elegant the way it does
it
that.
Expands your horizon and that sort of thing, and that all makes perfect sense. That's what I really really like about the system.
I think the only other thing that we probably didn't do that I think is quite integral to both Liminor and also is even more express in King of Dungeons from Baz is about the development of the crew.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, obviously within his game it works in a slightly different way, but in Liminor, it's, as you said, you start to build up enmities or alliances, yeah, with people, but within the group as well you add things to the group. You know, you can choose to take a bonus for the group through the experience system, you know, the development system. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that would be another thing I think we probably would have probably expanded on, I think, if we'd come on for longer.
Yeah.
That's
actually a common campaign thing, though, I guess.
Just coming back to your earlier point, Doc, about the combat system, I think the experience that I had was when we played a while back Judge Dredd and we used the Traveller system, and we did a lot of, it was all investigation and, you know, learning stuff, and then you got to combat and it just slowed right down to a crawl. So that's the point where I threw out the Traveller system and we actually went to Gumshoe. But I think you're right, actually. I think it didn't add drama. It was, well, we're just trying to roll dice to see what happened at the end. And that's not necessarily criticism of the system, because it's not a combat game, is it? That's the thing. It's not about that.
Do you think it's more a case of getting back to the your jeopardy? So some of the combats didn't have a sense of jeopardy, whereas that last combat did.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say, so quite a few of them did, but and also I'd suspect Doc may not have felt it quite as much as the rest of us, because his character was such an absolute badass as well. but I guess if you're fighting a couple of goblins or whatever in a fantasy game, you might not perceive that as such a big threat. But when you're fighting 20 goblins or five ogres or whatever, there's a much greater chance of loss.
I get that. I do get that, because I think it's interesting, and this is just a reflection as a GM generally, is that you want to throw a bit of action into the game. And so in Liminor, where's the action? So you've got the social interactions that can have jeopardy in certain ways. But if you want to put in people in physical, or the characters rather than physical danger, hopefully not people, characters, then how do you... And that's a much broader conversation. But in Liminor, your immediate go-to is let's make it a combat thing. But having said that, when you were up against the Fae, then I think you felt danger.
I think
that was there. But it wasn't combat. So it's interesting, really.
So he was nicking our stuff again, Steve.
It's a perfectly valid tactic, I think you'll find.
I think there were a couple of occasions, and actually I think possibly one thing that I think you changed, and you were taking sort of systems from elsewhere. There was quite a bit of jeopardy when we were being chased, or when we were involved. And I know certainly, Neil, your character was. I was chased by, in the very beginning, in fact, it might have been the first session, chased by a group of local thugs. And that was good, you know, the way so that might be a mechanic that would be worthwhile seeing, that sort of chase type sequence where you've either got to flee from somebody or you are actually trying to hunt somebody down. That might be worthwhile Mitch looking at.
The system is so open at the moment. I mean, I don't have the Pax Londinium book, so I was going from the main book, is that there's so much potential that I would quite happily, just by expansion after expansion, just going into things like, you know, like a chase system, like an extra combat system. And, you know, I mean, some of the things that we did, like the your character Magpie's Watson interface that he used to, you know, I'm thinking like, well, there's a whole add-on book just all in itself about how you can start using some of that. So I think there's tons of potential to have many more books, and that's why I think it does feel a little bit World of Darkness, in that, you know, we have that core world right now, and the world building is so big and so open, and there's so much potential that it's I'm going to end up having a shelf full of Liminor, and, you know,
because they look great as well. So a question, Kale, is it 5th edition Vampire? Would you rather run it with the existing system that's in Vampire, or would you jump over to something like Liminor?
Oh, now that's a really interesting one. I know Vampire so well, so that's a system where you know, I know what I should be looking at, even if I don't know the rules off by heart. I know where I should look to find them. With Liminor, that's an interesting one. I think if I was going to set it in the UK, then Liminal would absolutely be a contender, because it has that that great British sensibility. It would have
that sense to it,
green and pleasant land. Okay. But you know, who can say?
No. Not sure. You're unwilling to commit.
I'm on the fence, uncharacteristically on the fence.
Okay.
There's nothing that would stop you from adding a, you know, like, let's say you were playing vampires and you want to make it War World of Darkness. There's nothing to stop you from adding a blood trait.
Yeah, some discipline. I mean, it's very easy to bolt stuff onto that sort of system, because it is straightforward.
But if it wasn't married to, you know, the concept of clan and all of those factions, I think Liminal would be a really good alternative for a sort of clanless vampire game.
But who's to say that the people who were vampires in the Liminal game hadn't read all the old World of Darkness stuff, that actually based their own based their own clan structure on stuff they'd read in 1990s
that's
stuff.
Too meta, even
so. So we talked about background setting quite a lot. We talked about rules. Okay, so let's perhaps just turn now to talk about our game, really. And again, you know, not thinking necessarily about, you know, player or GM, because as Doc says, it's, you know, it's collaborative. So how well do you think we managed to bring out elements of the background and as it's talked about in the Liminal rules? I mean, for me, I was very conscious when I was creating the story that I wanted it to be based where I live. I wanted it to be based around Mercia and Anglo-Saxons, because I love that stuff, and watching Last Kingdom was, you know, what I was into as well. And actually, it was quite easy to embed parts of what was in the Liminal background. So the woman that got kidnapped, the mage from House of Nun, the Black Alchemist was trying to retrieve her partner who had been taken by the Winter King. That's where I started from. So yeah, it worked really well. I mean, from my perspective, I was really pleased with the whole game played out. I mean, what are you, from your perspective, what do you guys think?
For me, it was that it started out as a mystery, and then it evolved into all these connections to the various factions. So it wasn't as clear cut as finding a bad, evil magic user. It was a lot more complex than that. And that's what I really enjoyed.
It's a balance, isn't it? Not trying to make it too complex. Everyone gets lost.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think a couple of times we probably did disappear up. I'll say
off the map.
I'll say blind alleys, but it was everybody wanting to, I guess, sort of use their characters to find out more, to sort of explore more, I think really worked. And the fact that it's not just one sort of breadcrumb chucked in front of you. It's like a couple of loaves, and okay, now sort out which bits you're supposed to be looking at. What's the next one we're gonna go down the route of? Because I think I'm pretty sure by about sort of maybe session two or three, I was sort of thinking, oh, okay, I know where this is going. And then all of a sudden, it's like, holy, what the hell's going on now?
But I saw the characters growing actually as we were going through the game. So like Kay's characters are becoming much more embedded into the background, the whole Mar Trent thing. And Ortis, so Neil's characters, you know, getting very much into the, you know, the Mercury Collegium, as he really starts to inhabit that wide boy sort of thing. Yeah. And again, I think that was, again, you could see that the characters were settling in.
Yeah, I thought there was some great interaction between the characters, you know. They were all very different, but driven by this discovering what was going on. But even then, there was very definite sense that they were, even though perhaps they hadn't known each other previously, they were quickly bonding. Yeah, I mean, that became quite apparent even quite early on when I started playing with Ortis. You know, we got into that scrap that he was part of the team and he was useful and that kind of thing, you know. So
it's interesting, Neil, that you talked about drive, the characters' drives, because in the character sheet, the concept...
Yeah, we didn't get that, did we?
The concept of drive was something that we really struggled with, and I'd kind of come up with this...
We missed that, yeah.
Jess was going to be this massive eco-warrior, and, you know, and that was kind of her character. But actually, towards the end of... And it wasn't really until right at the end when we drilled it down into its very essence, into something really simple, as in, what is this drive? That I, you know, my character Jess, and we sort of worked out that actually Jess, who was very, very working class, sort of lower working class, you know, really, really quite poor, impoverished, and very much in the kind of fey kind of world with the river spirits, actually had exactly the same drive as Monty, who was this, you know, he went around in the Rolls and all this kind of stuff. And just right at the end, she kind of worked out that all they wanted, both of them wanted to do was protect. And then there was this kind of bond that happened at the end. And it was so good that I was like, wow, you know, this is something where we've drilled down through what we think drive is as players to actually what drive is as a character. And some really good role playing came out of that, which is brilliant.
Yeah, it was good fun. I mean, I think that's one of the key things that if I was going to run it again, which I probably will at some point, is with drive, just to make it one word.
Yeah.
Because then it's much easier to actually apply it. Because if you have a more complex drive, it just gets lost. And it's actually quite an important thing, because if you engage your drive, you get experience from it, because it makes you play in character.
And the way we graded our drives was they make perfect sense for the character as part of the character's personality and so forth. But they weren't necessarily always applicable in the game itself.
Yeah, I think if you making it something much shorter, more concise, means it can be applied more regularly. But I also think if you put in it's one of the advantages of using your drive, if I've got this right, is you get some of your will back.
Yeah.
So if you're in a situation where you're not necessarily using your will, is it will or willpower, whichever one it is? Okay, so if you're not using that, you may not feel the incentive to engage your drive. So I think again, going back to situations that create challenges and jeopardy, if you have things which happened later on in the game, I think it happened more. We were kind of, there was a point where we were almost burning through will. And then we were all kind of going, oh, how can I use my drive here? And I think you were being quite lenient with us. but I think that's the thing. So it's that relationship between will. So if, as a GM, if you want to get people to use the drives, you kind of
put them drain their will a bit, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
But
yeah.
It is an economy.
Yeah.
But you've got the choice. You either get your will back or get XP. So it's good in either way.
I just thought of something. What it would be even better if there's a discrepancy between magic users and non-magic users in the will use. Everything of magic costs you will.
Uh-huh.
And people who don't have magic can spend will to improve their die rolls.
Yeah.
That effect of improving the die rolls is really, really expensive for magic users.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, certainly the skills and sort of proficiencies and things that actually give you additional will if you use magic. And I think, but actually, I think that's one of the things I do like about the game, is that actually you don't have these vast. So, within, say, Call of Cthulhu, you could have up to 99 points of luck to burn your way through, and then they sort of get refreshed almost ad hoc. Whereas with this game, I think you have to conserve that. And if you are going to undertake lots of magical activity, you've got to have one eye on, if this doesn't work, or if I get myself into a difficult situation, I've got to be a bit more careful with it. And you have to husband it perhaps a bit better. But then you have, as you said before, you've got that, if you've got a very snappy, and I think that one word thing with regard to drive, I think is absolutely brilliant. If you can apply that one word, then you have the opportunity to bring that back, which ought to encourage you to role play. I take the point. You know, if you're a magic user, you can, if you use magic rather, you could burn through things very quickly.
I suppose it's given as many opportunities to people to use will as possible, because then you're more likely to succeed on rolls, because succeeding is cool, but then when you start to get into situations where you're starting to run out, you can, as Doc says, you can engage your drive, and then you get, or if you only spend a couple of points of will, then you get the experience check, don't you? So it is, I think it's quite it, that again, I think the whole thing is quite, system is quite elegant. Okay, so I think pretty much come to an end here. So background setting, we've talked about obviously the rules, and we've made reference to the game all the way through. But do you think that, given the experience that we've had, do you think it'd be something that you would want to come back to, either as Liminal as a whole or those characters as they were? What are your thoughts?
Definitely both.
Yes.
Definitely come back to Liminal. But I think we really just started to work out who our characters were and how they actually might work together as a team. And it was that team dynamic that was starting to get really interesting for me. And I think because the world is so big, you know, I really hope that, that Jess and Monty and Otis and everybody get back together and have, you know, future hijinx adventures. I think we need some kind of mystery mobile, although obviously it's going to be a British make. So, yeah, some old Ford Transit.
Well, if we could have a Land Rover Discovery, it could then trigger my
brilliant. Will. Yeah. I mean, to be honest, the whole thing felt like an origin story, really. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I think you know, the way we finished it with Magpie's character coming back from the land of Fae with his googly eye, and that it just felt like. Actually, there was a launching point for another game, and it was a pleasure to play. I really enjoyed it. I think I learned a lot about, you know, how I do Liminal in future through playing it, and I'd certainly be very happy to come back to Liminal and to those characters at some point once I've managed to get through all the other things on my list of things I've got to play.
I was going to say, it does sound like you've got something in mind now, Steve.
Got some thoughts.
Always got something in mind.
Always planning. Always planning. Yeah. All right.
Is it a mashup? Is it vampires in space?
Oh, that's a good one. I'll write that one down.
With Traveller.
Yeah. That sounds quite cool, actually.
Time travel. Because there's time travel rules in the Pax Londinium. Chronomancy, isn't there? So
Travelers of Lemuria, perhaps?
All right. Okay. Anyway. Thanks, guys. That was brilliant conversation. So, I think we're done.
Thanks for listening to another exploration of my gaming vexes. If you've got any thoughts you'd like to add to what you've heard here, or a gaming vex of your own you'd like to offer up for discussion, you can contact me on Twitter at AllAnthar, or you can leave a voice message. The link's on the podcast webpage on Anchor, or can be found in the show notes. Until the next time, may all your games be free of vexatiousness, and be excellent to each other, always.